This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the January 6th committee changed up its schedule, and as the kids say, a new episode just dropped.
A sudden announcement of a hearing later on today, set to share what it says is recently obtained evidence.
It did not disappoint. Among the details, we learned that President Trump shrugged off concerns that many in the crowd he was propelling to the Capitol were armed.
I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, "I don't effing care that they have weapons. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away."
That's Cassidy Hutchinson, former aide to Trump's then chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and this week's surprise witness. As she told it, when the crowd chanted, "Hang Mike Pence," Meadows told her that Trump said he didn't think there was anything wrong with that. In fact, he longed to lead the gun-packing crowd to the Capitol himself, even lunging for the wheel, allegedly, to get himself there. And as this week's hearing built on the foundations laid by earlier ones, it grew even clearer that the president had long been in the process of stage managing a real coup that would pull in enough viewers to guarantee him a second season. But the management of the Select Committee's investigation, the rolling revelations, the made-for-sharing sound bites, the primetime scheduling, is just as remarkable. Because never, at least in my lifetime, has a congressional committee ever used the available media with such savvy. And I watched the Watergate hearings and tapes of the Army McCarthy hearings the year before I was born.
"Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?"
Tonight, I say this to my Republican colleagues who are defending the indefensible. There will come a day when Donald Trump is gone, but your dishonor will remain.
The temperate committee chair, Benny Thompson, and the hard-boiled vice chair, Liz Cheney, were complimentary Dantes guiding us through the rankness, as when Cheney concluded with stunning evidence that threatening messages to witnesses had already been sent.
"Here's another sample in a different context. This is a call received by one of our witnesses. Quote, 'A person let me know you have your deposition tomorrow. He wants me to let you know he's thinking about you. He knows you're loyal and you're going to do the right thing when you go in for your deposition.' I think most Americans know that attempting to influence witnesses to testify untruthfully presents very serious concerns."
It was a warning to the miscreants, followed by an offer of redemption by Benny Thompson, that it's never too late to move out of the darkness into the light.
"And to that group of witnesses, if you've heard this testimony today and suddenly you remember things you couldn't previously recall, or there are some details you'd like to clarify, or you discovered some courage you had hidden away somewhere, our doors remain open."
Doors ajar in the halls of Congress are oddities, often signs of great confidence or even greater stupidity. Here, the Select Committee is prompting audience participation in lieu of recitation and speechifying. The discussion builds on Twitter and TikTok, a call and response from all sides, of course. This week we heard of anonymous Secret Service people saying that the witnesses to that infamous lunge were ready to recant. We'll see. Trump may be indicted, or not. But the Select Committee hearing, now striving to save our democracy, could serve as an unexpected template for a new mode of democratic discussion. Yeah, it has some of the trappings of true crime. But if it stays true, and it still gets us to care, then on its own, it stands as a triumph of democracy. When it came to gun control in the headlines this week, it was the best and the worst of times. There was the signing of the first major gun safety legislation passed by Congress in nearly 30 years.
The bill is a bipartisan deal that would expand gun background checks for people under 21, allowing up to 10 business days to review juvenile and mental health records. It provides federal money for states enacting new red flag laws designed to temporarily seize guns from people deemed dangerous. And it closes the so-called boyfriend loophole, preventing partners convicted of domestic abuse who live outside a victim's home from buying a gun.
Then, a change-up on Thursday, when the Supreme Court struck down a century-old New York law that restricted the carrying of guns outside the home without proper cause, ruling that Americans have a constitutional right to arm themselves in public.
Now, this is the most significant Second Amendment ruling in more than a decade. In a 6-3 decision, the court struck down New York's law, which places restrictions on concealed handguns. That law was enacted more than a century ago.
This prompted outrage at Manhattan's Union Square.
We are enraged. We are disgusted.
This ruling is the third major Supreme Court decision regarding gun rights, following Heller in 2008 and McDonald in 2010. Heller asserted that the Second Amendment guarantees the right to possess firearms for self-defense independent of service in a state militia.
A decisive ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court saying Americans can keep guns at home for self-defense.
2 years later, McDonald reaffirmed Heller that the right of an individual to keep and bear arms is enforceable against the states. Last week's ruling, however, represents a noticeable shift away from what we typically discuss when it comes to gun control, from who is entitled to carry a firearm and what kind of firearm, to where a firearm can be carried. The next major gun debate in the high court, says Timothy Zick, law professor at William & Mary Law School, will be a battle over where guns are and aren't allowed. And the only weapon gun-regulating states can wield in this battle? History, and history alone.
In most states, in fact, you had the right to concealed carry or open carry or both, handguns primarily, but also in some states, long guns.
But you wrote that both red and blue states also were chock full of bans on public carry in a host of locations, including public transit, polling places, athletic facilities, public swimming pools, riverboat casinos, and so on.
And ironically, even in one state, gun shows. So what the states appear to have recognized is that as robust as one might want public carry rights to be, there were certain places where one might not want people to be armed, either in a concealed fashion or openly carrying firearms.
And that could include airports, financial institutions, theaters, hotel lobbies, tribal lands. In the piece you wrote with Diana Palmer for The Atlantic, you wrote that, quote, "The question of sensitive places is now front and center, and it's a sign of where the country is with its gun laws, fighting over the margins of its expansive gun freedoms, not whether those freedoms should be so expansive in the first place."
Well, Bruin itself is going to drive a serious change in how courts at least approach gun rights. But, of course, the movement toward Bruin has been brewing at least since Heller in 2008 and the McDonald case in 2010. For the first time, the Supreme Court recognized an individual right to keep and bear arms, not a right connected to service in a state militia, which had been the understanding of lower federal courts, commentators, etc. I mean, there were breadcrumbs in the Heller case and the McDonald case that the Second Amendment was never going to be limited to the home. When you talk about the right of self-defense, and you rule out certain places where guns aren't going to be allowed, you're suggesting very strongly that there are going to be places where they are allowed.
But didn't the Heller case confirm that guns could be banned from some sensitive places? And didn't the Bruin case reaffirm this?
Yes. So in Heller, the court said no rights are absolute, and that includes the Second Amendment. So there are what it called longstanding limitations on the right under the Second Amendment that the court was not questioning. Among those are bans on possession by convicted felons, by persons who have a mental disability, and bans, the court said, in sensitive places, including schools and government buildings, certain places where a ban or a restriction would be presumptively constitutional.
So the phrase sensitive places, Justice Scalia coined the term in the Heller case, and he wrote that nothing in his majority opinion should cast doubt on laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places. So what did he mean by sensitive places?
Yeah, the court never actually defines what sensitive means. It gives two examples categorically, schools and government buildings, and it doesn't say what sensitivity entails or what it means. So the lower court struggled to try and define it place by place, and they dealt with things like, is a post office building sensitive? Is the parking lot outside the post office sensitive? Are places populated by particularly sensitive audiences, like schools? Is it what goes on in the place that makes it sensitive? Maybe a legislative chamber because of the democratic process that takes place there?
Now, the New York defense in Bruin claimed that Manhattan is a densely populated area that is policed. We have people with guns to keep the public peace. And therefore, the entirety of Manhattan Island is a sensitive place with no need for people to carry guns. The court didn't buy that, obviously.
No, it did not. So whatever sensitive places means, it cannot mean, according to Justice Thomas and the majority, that you can take an entire city or the island of Manhattan and proclaim it a sensitive place. It has to be more specific, more granular than that. The majority mentioned polling places, courthouses, and the reason it focused on those, and it said there are very few historical examples of places where guns could be prohibited, is because what's going to drive the court's review of gun regulations going forward is history.
And you wrote that Bruin's a bombshell, because it's telling us that in order to determine which places are sensitive, you have to prove that it's been historically treated as such. History is pretty subjective, right?
Some have criticized what's called a text history and tradition approach as subjective, subject to manipulation. It's not objective, as the court claims. For its part, the majority recognized that, look, finding historical analogies for subways, for example, may be difficult. But the court's convinced it's not impossible, that you can do what it called analogical reasoning, find historical analogs, lay them next to modern regulations, and decide whether those regulations are constitutional. That's going to be a very big part of litigation going forward, but it is going to raise lots of difficulties in terms of, as you say, how do you treat the island of Manhattan and its subway system when in 1791, there was no such thing? That's going to be the big challenge, particularly for governments that are trying to uphold gun regulations. They bear the burden under the court's approach of finding these historical analogs in early state laws from the 18th century primarily. That's not going to be an easy task.
So let's talk about one particular failed analogy brought up by Justice Breyer during the Bruin hearing. He was talking about the Statute of Northampton in his dissent. This was a law enacted in England in 1328, stating that, quote, no man, great or small, of what condition soever he be, could go nor ride armed by night nor day in fairs, markets, nor in the presence of the justices or other ministers, nor in no parts elsewhere upon pain to forfeit their armor to the king and their bodies to prison at the king's pleasure. That's pretty clear. I gather the court wasn't keen on this as a precedent.
Well, it downplayed the significance of the Northampton statute on a number of different grounds, one of which was, look, it's simply too old to tell us anything about how the Second Amendment right was understood in the colonies and the early states.
Was it too old?
Well, the court didn't seem to think so when it was canvassing history in Heller and MacDonald. The English common law and the English statutory law seems to be relevant, at least. But the court's simply unwilling to place a great deal of weight on a 14th century English statute.
The statute was in force well into the 18th century, wasn't it?
Yes, and states adopted it as a model. And the court then had to work around all of those state laws that seemed to accept the statute's principle of disarming people in crowded places. That's what a lot of the opinion is about. It's taking historical analogs that to New York State seem perfectly relevant and deriding them as irrelevant. And the court just says, well, in New York's case, its law is invalid regardless of which of those historical periods we look at. So we don't need to decide today, this will be a future case issue, which historical periods are relevant. So on that macro level, you have that problem. And then you get into the micro question. Suppose that it was just well understood that people shouldn't carry firearms into certain places, like churches, for example. But I don't have a law on the books or a series of laws, 25 laws that say that. And it's going to be a question, as I say, of finding a robust enough historical record to uphold a regulation. And if you can't do that as the government, then your law is invalid, regardless of any notion or interest you might have in public safety or dealing with the dangerousness of firearms. None of that matters. The only thing that matters is history.
So the decision in Bruin, I assume, means that some gun regulations that have been upheld by lower courts for a long time could be revisited. Prohibitions on gun use by felons and those who are mentally ill.
So one of the things that Bruin does right off the bat is to say that what the lower courts have been doing in terms of reviewing gun regulations is wrong. The methodology that the courts have been using, we reject, we the Supreme Court. Laws that were upheld under that methodology will be reconsidered, relitigated under this text, history, and tradition approach. Some of them may survive, many of them may not. We've had over 1,000 cases in the lower courts since Heller was decided. Most federal courts have adopted a sort of two-step approach, which is part historical analysis, but also the sort of means end in public safety analysis. That's now been ruled out.
This shift to an examination of sensitive places, these future searches for historical analogies, you don't seem very hopeful that that will have much impact.
I'm hopeful in the sense that the court itself identifies schools, government buildings, polling places, legislatures, courthouses. Those are not insignificant. Whether you can find historical analogs for, say, bans of firearms on university campuses and other places, I think is an open question. And I think the court has set this up in a way that makes it very difficult for the government to carry what the court says is its burden. Now, there are plenty of people devoted to scouring that historical record, finding evidence that you may not even know exists. In that sense, I am somewhat hopeful, at least. Some places will be deemed off limits. You know, New York's authorities are already looking at adding to the sort of sensitive place restrictions they already have. Other states and localities, to the extent they're allowed to, will also be looking in that direction.
And you wrote that if the states can no longer use discretion to limit the number of people and places with guns, something needs to be done to stem the flow of weapons. And yet, District of Columbia v. Heller found that strict regulation of gun ownership was unconstitutional. Do you have any thoughts about how to legally stem that flow?
Well, there are a number of things that states may be able to do. We've had multiple shootings by 18-year-olds. Should an 18-year-old have the right to purchase and carry a long gun or a handgun? There's certain types of arms that seem to show up more frequently in mass shootings. Should it be legal to purchase a semi-automatic long gun like an AR-15?
Although handguns obviously are behind the vast majority of gun deaths in this country.
Sure. You know, there is no one law that's going to solve this problem. I think part of the takeaway, if you read Justice Alito's opinion in Bruin, seems to be that, you know, the dissent spends a lot of time talking about gun deaths and gun violence, but it can't point to a law, including New York's, that would solve that problem. Well, of course, that's not how we treat law in general. Of course, murderers will murder despite laws that criminalize that activity. We can't simply throw up our hands and say no particular law is going to prevent gun violence in the United States. The court has left open at least some limitations, and states should certainly be looking in that direction, whether it's licensing requirements or sensitive places or what have you. This is not an easy area of law to understand.
Yeah.
Except to the extent, you know, you're being told, well, history's everything. But what the court has allowed and what states have done are two very different things. The states are well ahead of the court and have been for a while.
All right. Timothy, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Timothy Zick is a professor of law at William & Mary Law School and the author of the forthcoming book, Managed Dissent, The Law of Public Protest. Coming up, what makes Justice Clarence Thomas tick? This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.